In 1968, there was a behavioral researcher named John B. Calhoun who built a paradise, or at least the mouse version of a paradise. And this mouse paradise, it had unlimited food and water. There were no predators whatsoever. The climate was perfect. There was a very comfortable nesting space. There was more room than the population would ever need. And every variable that normally would limit a mouse population had been removed. So the whole thing was specifically engineered so that nothing could go wrong. I mean, it was a literal utopia. And then he just stepped back and he watched what unfolded. So initially, the population exploded, as you might expect. And then around the 600 mouse mark, something started to change. Calhoun noticed that the social fabric started to come apart in ways that weren't really hard to recognize at first. So some parts of the colony actually got more violent, and other parts became weirdly quiet. Reproduction started to slow down naturally, and then something especially strange started happening. There was a subset of male mice that did something that Calhoun found harder to explain than the violence. So this group of mice, they just stopped. They basically just stopped participating in mouse life completely. And it wasn't because they were sick or injured or anything like that. They just withdrew from the colony's social world, and they spent their time eating and grooming themselves with what Calhoun described as almost obsessive, with an obsessive attention. So they were in perfect physical condition with a complete behavioral absence. And he gave these mice a nickname. He called them the beautiful ones. All right, so the official name for the Mouse Utopia experiment was is Universe 25. And so once the population finally peaked at around 2,200 mice, it reached a tipping point and it started to collapse. And so by the end of the downfall, there were no new mice being born at all. And I think one of the things that makes Universe 25 particularly disturbing is that it didn't end from disease or starvation or, you know, any of the usual suspects. It ended from something that took Calhoun a number of years to actually understand and define properly, which we're going to get to. So, I've been thinking about the beautiful ones on and off for a while now because I've noticed an interesting correlation to some rather disturbing things that are happening in our society currently. One of which is this phenomenon, which you may have heard of, that's coming from Japan, known as hikikomori. This is where you have a growing number of mostly young men who are withdrawing so completely from society that their bedroom pretty much has become their entire world. And, well, this isn't just happening in Japan, by the way. I mean, this is happening in other countries around the world as well. And, well, the other thing that the beautiful ones made me think of is this whole looks maxing trend that's happening, where you have mostly young men who have become obsessively focused on optimizing their physical appearance while withdrawing from any meaningful social interaction. I mean, this is basically grooming as a substitute for actual living, right? Which is, well, not to be too on the nose about this, it does seem to be almost exactly what Calhoun was watching in 1968 in mice, before any of this had a name. All right, so the more popular interpretation of Universe 25 is that it was just an issue of overpopulation. There were too many mice, there wasn't enough space, so the system collapsed. End of story, right? I mean, it's a clean, simple, but slightly terrifying analysis. However, as it turns out, that is not quite what happened. And Calhoun spent years trying to push back against that interpretation because he believed that it missed the more disturbing point, which is that the collapse was ultimately about roles. More specifically, the collapse of meaningful roles. So what happened was, when the population got dense enough, the normal behaviors that constitute mouse life, such as, you know, establishing territory and courting and mating and raising young, navigating the social hierarchy and so forth, these things became functionally pointless. There was no unclaimed territory. And so the social structures were just too crowded to navigate in any way that produced results, meaningful results. And, you know, when effort consistently produces nothing, well, then you eventually stop making the effort, right? And if you think about it, that's actually pretty reasonable. I mean, the mice, they were just doing like cost-benefit analysis and coming to the conclusion that participation just wasn't really worth it anymore. Which, really, that's an extremely relatable thing to do. And, it's also apparently how civilizations end. So the next time someone accuses you of doing a cost-benefit analysis of, getting off the couch, you can tell them, look, you're just stress testing the social contract. Very important work. All right, so the beautiful ones were the extreme endpoint of this experiment. So not only had they just reduced their effort, they completely opted out. And what they replaced participation with was this grooming process and this obsessive superficial maintenance in the absence of any life behind it. So they had the perfect coat, no engagement, which means, you know, they were technically present, but they weren't really there. There's sort of a vacancy, which is also a pretty accurate description of what happens to most people's souls somewhere around year four of a job that they took for the health insurance. Yeah. So anyway, the part about Calhoun's conclusion that gets buried in the whole overpopulation narrative is that the colony didn't collapse because there were too many mice. It collapsed because the conditions had eliminated any reason to do the things that make a mouse a mouse. Because, well, if you take away the meaningful roles, then the behavior stopped. And if the behavior stopped, then the population follows. Which, I don't know, I kind of see that as a rather poetic, devastating summary of what happens when a species runs out of reasons to keep going. So, all right, let's get a little philosophical here, because what Calhoun kept trying to say, and also what was getting overshadowed by, you know, the simpler overpopulation story, is that the mice didn't run out of resources. They ran out of reasons. And I think that distinction actually matters quite a lot, because what it's doing is it's pointing at something that's much harder to fix than just a food shortage. So there was a psychiatrist named Viktor Frankl who survived Nazi concentration camps to eventually write a very moving book called Man's Search for Meaning. And so he came out the other side of that whole experience with a pretty specific observation about human beings existing under these horrific conditions. So Frankl pointed out that the desire for meaning is the primary human drive. It's not pleasure, it's not even safety. It's actually meaning. Which makes me think of this quote, this well-known quote from Nietzsche, where he stated, "He who has a why to live can bear almost any how." And, another thing that Frankl said that I think applies here is that people who could find or construct meaning in even the most terrible circumstances, these people had a much better chance of surviving than people who couldn't do that. And this is probably the most disturbing possible inversion of Universe 25, because Frankl watched humans living in these conditions of absolute deprivation and starvation, you know, violence of all sorts, obviously, you know, just existing in complete absence of freedom or comfort of any kind, right? And yet, somehow, some of these people kept finding reasons to keep going. They still somehow found enough meaning to survive. Now, I suppose you could argue that they were delusional, but interestingly, it was their delusion that kept them alive. So, I don't know. Go figure. Something to think about. Now, on the other hand, Calhoun was watching mice in conditions the opposite. They were in conditions of absolute abundance, who nonetheless completely lost their meaning and their reasons. And I think it's fair to say that the mice actually fare just as badly. And, well, speaking of Nietzsche, who, by the way, you know, he usually gets misinterpreted as a nihilist, though I'd say he was actually more of a nihilism diagnostician. Well, his whole project was primarily the old meaning-making frameworks are collapsing, and this is what happens if nothing replaces them, and here's why that's a catastrophic problem. So his prescription, it wasn't really about power the way most people think of it. It was about the existential act of creation of your own values and meaning when the inherited ones stop working. Which is, you know, a great idea in the same way that just build your own house is a great idea, right? It's definitely easier said than done. And then, this also makes me think about the Romanian philosopher, Emil Cioran, who was certainly closer to being a nihilist than Nietzsche was. And so his argument was that existence was basically a catastrophic mistake, and that consciousness was the universe's cruelest joke on any creature unfortunate enough to develop consciousness. So yeah, he was fun at parties. Though to be fair, I mean, he did have a rather hilarious gallows humor about this stuff. And, you know, funny enough, even Cioran kept writing almost every day for most of his life, which I think says something about the human need, this underlying human need for meaning that has this way of turning up for even the most committed philosophical pessimist. All right. So I want to talk a little bit more about the beautiful ones, because I do feel that they need a little more analysis. So they weren't the violent or chaotic mice in the colony. They were the ones who had, by every visible measure, they'd opted out of the whole project, and they managed to look fantastic while doing it. I mean, they had the perfect coat, no visible stress whatsoever, but there was absolutely nothing going on behind the eyes. I guess you could argue that they were dead inside. So the beautiful ones weren't depressed in any clinical sense, right? I mean, they weren't anxious, they weren't in any kind of pain, they just simply had arrived somewhere else. They arrived at a place a place of participation had been weighed against the returns and found wanting. And so they set up camp there permanently. A very well-groomed camp, but a camp nonetheless. And what I find both fascinating and pretty uncomfortable about this is that, you know, from the outside, it looked fine, right? I mean, it looked like a mouse that had achieved some kind of peace and contentment. It was basically like the Instagram highlight reel version of mouse life. So, you know, beautiful on the surface, but nothing behind it, right? And so I kept wondering, if you encountered a so-called beautiful one in the wild before you had any context, you'd probably think, yeah, that mouse really has their shit together. Look at that nice shiny coat. I mean, whatever that mouse is doing, it's definitely working. But meanwhile, that mouse has essentially ghosted its entire species, like it had filed a change of address to nowhere. And by the way, the rest of the colony noticed this, and some of the other mice did try to engage with them, but they were ignored. Which, if you know, if you've ever tried to make plans with someone who has fully entered their hermit era, it requires no further explanation. And there was an important point that I do think needs to be explained here before we go any further, because, well, the mouse utopia, you know, that comparison only works if you accept that we've built something like a utopia in our society. And that's not really the kind of comparison I'm trying to make here, because I'm well aware that for the vast majority of people, that would be a very deeply uncomfortable claim, of course. I mean, you know, when you've got 37% of people in the U.S. who can't even cover a $400 emergency, implying that we live in some kind of utopia sounds absurd, right? So I think the more accurate version of the parallel, it's not that we've built a utopia in our civilization, it's that we've built one for some people, obviously, and we've created the illusion of one for pretty much everyone else. So what we have is something more like a dystopia with the illusion of it a utopia, which of course has been propagated by our technology through our screens and you know, all the streaming and the endless distraction of false comfort, plus all of the consumerism and so on and so forth. And, well, it turns out that the illusion might be doing some of the same neurological work as the real thing, which is the part that, you know, should probably keep you up at night. So I guess it is actually keeping you up at night if you are up doom scrolling at 3 a.m. All right. So here is an interesting question that's been sitting underneath all of this that I think is definitely worth pondering. Is there a difference between the beautiful ones and the concept of enlightenment? Because I would guess that certain Buddhist and Zen traditions would probably look at the beautiful ones and see something almost admirable, right? I mean, there's non-attachment, there's freedom from desire, the cessation of striving, of grasping. There's no suffering. There's just presence. And, you know, I guess depending on your tradition, that's either a goal of a lifetime of practice or it's just a mouse that gave up. And from the outside, those two things look suspiciously similar. Actually, this whole thing also kind of reminds me of Schopenhauer, because, well, his focus was pretty much on this exact problem. So Schopenhauer was convinced that wanting things is the primary source of suffering, and that the path of escape goes through deliberately quieting the will. So it's a process where you're stepping back from desire and from striving and you know, from the whole tiresome process of wanting anything, which actually sounds a lot like Buddhism when you think about it, right? Though, I would say Schopenhauer was, you know, he wasn't any kind of a Buddhist really, but you could argue that he was like a Zen master curmudgeon or a curmudgeonly Zen master maybe. I don't know, take your pick. So the actual distinction that I think matters here is that the Zen master and the beautiful ones might look identical from the outside, right? But the path is the difference because it's not attachment that's achieved through engagement and through, having tried and lost and tried again, which is a completely different thing from withdrawal as a default. When one of them is a destination and the other is just not leaving. But so Calhoun believed that the behavioral sink was reversible because he did spend his later years trying to design what he called conceptual space. So conceptual space is, well, it's environments that preserve meaningful social roles, even at a high density. So his point of this being that what mice and humans need even more than physical room or physical space is they need the psychological and social space to do things that actually matter. And they need to have roles that produce results. So, what we desire is to be needed in ways that require actually showing up. But now the problem is that these algorithmically optimized environments that we built for passive consumption and rewarding surface over substance, those environments are killing that conceptual space. And it's making the meaningful roles harder to find and harder to perform. So I guess you could actually look at the beautiful ones like an early warning system for what happens when that conceptual space just completely disappears. And well, I guess given that you're probably watching this on a screen right now, that's information maybe worth considering before you open another tab. So, all right, I guess here is where I find myself with all of this. So Calhoun watched his mice, and he kept asking this question, what would have to be present for the behavioral sink to reverse? And his answer kept going back to the same place, which is, again, meaningful roles. Even just the presence of something worth doing that required you to show up to do it. Apparently, even that is enough to make a difference. Which I realize probably sounds like the most obvious conclusion in the history of behavioral science. And yet, it is still somehow the hardest one to act on. But I guess, well, that's the human condition for you. And when I think about the beautiful ones, I don't find them to be contemptible or anything. I actually find them to be familiar in some respect because, well, first of all, their withdrawal from, the colony, it makes sense. I mean, I guess the grooming to some degree makes sense. And the thing is when the participation stops producing results, the calculation changes. And when you have meaningful roles getting crowded out and algorithmically replaced or just made irrelevant, I guess, the cost-benefit analysis, it's always the same. I think the withdrawal part makes a lot of sense for a lot of people right now. I mean, I've been making videos about that concept, you know. And you know, there are some people who've managed to find their way back out of it, who will tell you that it's going to involve doing something hard enough to matter. I mean, in this world, you know, this is a world that keeps trying to make everything frictionless now, and therefore make us docile. And so I think the question that Calhoun was really trying to ask, and I think the question that Universe 25 is asking, it isn't whether we are the beautiful ones. I mean, that's not really the comparison here, as I've said before. The real question is what we're going to do with the conceptual space that we have left. I mean, you know, whether we're going to use it for something that requires us to be present, or whether we're going to spend it maintaining, you know, this superficial surface while the interior goes quiet. I don't think the beautiful ones m made that choice to become what they became. That was actually chosen by the environment that they were in. And I think that's the part that really hits home here. You know, whether we have more choice than the mice did, well, that's still up for debate. So I guess this is the most honest place to leave this. There's not really an answer here so much as there's a bigger and more, you know, more important question. And also I guess the faint, slightly uncomfortable hope that asking that question out loud counts for something. I don't know, time will tell. So yeah, there you have it. I guess that is all I have today on that particular topic. Thank you so much for listening.